Tom, come to order. Messages from the House.
January 21st, 2013, from the House of Representatives. Message number 152, third reading, failed. Mr. President, the bill listed below failed to pass a House third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 144, Kindergarten Readiness Programs. Ayes 26, noes 13, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. January the 21st, 2013, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 6, Solid Waste Disposal District Board Terms. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill number 49, Legislature Certificates of Attendance. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill number 50, Distribution of Bills. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill number 57, Constituent Service Allowance. Ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. And House Bill number 92, Interference with Emergency Calls. Ayes 53, noes 6, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. January the 21st, 2013, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 86, Child Placement Orders. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill number 115, Wrongful Death Tolling of Statutes of Limitations. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 119, Department of Family Services Programs. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 82, Interstate Sales of Health Insurance. Ayes 38, noes 21, excused 1. House Bill number 90, Recreation Liability Aircraft Activities. Ayes 57, noes 2, excused 1. House Bill number 100, Vehicle Registration Fees Assistive Devices. Ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 116, Select Federal Natural Resource Management Committee. Ayes 59, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Introduction, reading, and reference of bills. Senate File 146, first reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 146, Termination of Parental Rights, sponsored by Senator Escobel, an act relating to children.
Senate File 146 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senate File 133, first reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 133, Livestock Inspectors Search Warrant, sponsored by Senator Driscoll, and act relating to livestock.
Senate File 133 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Senate File 132, first reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 132, Silencers, Suppressors, and Automatic Weapons, sponsored by Senator Driscoll, and act relating to game and fish.
Senate File 132 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. Senate File 134, first reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 134, Voter Identification, sponsored by Senator Driscoll, and act relating to re-elections.
Senate File 134 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. House Bills on first reading. House Bill 69, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill Number 69, Highway Funding, sponsored by the Revenue Committee, an act relating to revenue for transportation purposes. Passed the House on third reading, ayes 35, noes 24, excused 1.
House Bill 69 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Reports from standing committees. Excuse me. Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, barring objection, I would like to request that Senate File 143, Cruelty to Animals, be re-referred from Judiciary Committee Number 1 to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands, and Water Resources.
What was that? Senate File 142, was that it?
143, sponsored by Chairman Geis.
Borrowing any objection, Senate File 153 will be re-referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture.
Mr. Chairman, that was 143, I'm sorry.
143. Senate File 143 is re-referred to Committee Number 5. Other announcements, or Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, may I have privilege at the floor?
Yes, you may.
Mr. President, there's been a lot of questions in regard to the activities within my family this afternoon, and so that I may answer them all at once, I'd like to say that I now have a new grandson. He's over 8 pounds. I have to say football runs in the family. His name is Joshua Ross, and he is joining two brothers and three sisters.
Well, congratulations.
You always want an IQ equal to your weight.
Mr. Reports from standing committees.
January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 97, Eligibility for Medicaid, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Senators Kraft, Nutting, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 48, Medicaid, Medical Assistant Hospice Care, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Senators Kraft, Nutting, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 101, Child Abuse Reporting Penalties, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 98, Motor Vehicle Lemon Law, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, and Schiffer. No, Senator Hicks, Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 56, Access to Records, Vulnerable Adult Abuse, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 92, Trespass Civil Penalty, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're at that order of business, consideration of bills in general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that we resolve back into committee hall.
All of the motion, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. President. We have another guest down here. We have this Isabella Summers. She's able to come today with her dad. Seeing as she didn't have school today, and had her come and sit with us for a minute, so can welcome her to the Senate.
Hey. Welcome to the Senate. Senator Emmerich.
Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration this afternoon is Senate File 83.
Senate File 83, Medicaid Fraud Recovery, sponsored by Senator Peterson, and Act relating to Medicaid. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Senators Kraft, Nutting, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 83 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment. I ask it be read in at this time.
Senate File 83, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 5, line 9.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Scott.
Chairman, I move adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I ask the Standing Committee Amendment be divided. Division 1 would be starting at line 34 on page 1 and would go all the way through the end of page 2. And then Division 2 would be the lines 1 through 33, then on page 1 of the amendment.
Senator Scott, you're saying Division 1 is 1 through 33?
Division 1 is lines 34 through the balance of page 1 and through the rest of and all of page 2. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, addressing Division 1, if I may.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, I asked to have this divided out. The committee had considerable trouble with the penalty section in this. The amendment that was adopted in committee, some of us had reservations about, and it has equal protection problems in it. The sponsors have a version coming next that doesn't have that problem. So I would ask the Senate respectfully to not adopt, to defeat this division of the Standing Committee Amendment. And I call for the question.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Division Number 1, to Senate File 83, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
That division has failed. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I yield to Senator Peterson, sponsor of the bill, to explain Division 2 of the Standing Committee Amendment, which I do urge we adopt, and to explain the bill.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to be as brief as I can. Fellow senators, this is a bill that's familiar to most of us, and I was just talking to my desk mate here. It reminds me of the Simon Garfunkel song, "Hello, Darkness, My Old Friend. I've come to sit with you again. This is an old friend of this body's, and I appreciate the past support on this bill." It's an important bill, Mr. Chairman, and the amendment. Basically, I would probably start by apologizing to the body. What I had filed was the original bills we started with at last session, and the amendment basically is what the Good Judiciary Committee did to it last year, and it was more reflective of the bill that left this good chamber. So with that in mind, I'll be brief just for the newer members to explain what this amendment is trying to do. On page 5, line 9, we've changed the dates of the days on that from 15 to 90 is the first portion of the amendment. And then, of course, we delete and renumber page 5, lines 15 and 16. We deleted that completely. That takes care of the 15 and 16, an innocent mistake shall be a defense to an action under this act. That was deleted completely by last year's committee. Page 6, line 23, that change was basically delete through under and insert alleged violations of. So just a change in wording there, more defined. The big amendment here is page 7, lines 4 through 21. We delete that entire section and replace it, starting on line 12 of your amendment, to say any employee, contractor, or agent. Now, this is in reference to the remedy for retaliation. Any employee, contractor, or agent of a person being investigated for a violation of Wyoming statute shall be entitled to recover all economic damages suffered if that employee, contractor, or agent is discharged, demoted, suspended, threatened, harassed, or in any other manner retaliated against in terms of conditions of employment. So this is a person maybe within an agency or a department or somebody that's filing for Medicaid claim who disagrees with the claim and sees that there's some wrongdoing, and so they, you might say, whistleblower, are cooperating with our AG's office, and this is just a part of the bill that basically protects them from any type of retaliation. Going on line 19, an action by an employee, contractor, or agent under this subsection shall not be brought more than 3 years after the date when the retaliation occurred. So there is a time frame in there, a time limit. Next part of the amendment, page 8, line 4, deleting this act and inserting subsection B of this section, again, more conforming language or definite language and better language by the good Judiciary Committee. Page 9, lines 23 and 24, we delete that completely. And that was basically, let me get to the right page here, Mr. Chairman. The old bill said this act shall be liberally construed and applied to promote the public interest. We thought that caused a little heartburn, so we deleted that, those two lines completely. Moving on, page 10 in line 2, because we deleted item B, we just had to renumber, and that would take the B to a or C to a B on page 10, line 2. And that is the first section of the amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I would stand for any questions, and I would urge the body to pass this part of the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Peterson, did you move that second division, or division, first division?
I think our chairman.
I believe that's correct.
Question?
Question's been called for. Are you ready for... All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Division 2 to Senate File 83. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is one other additional amendment. This is the amendment that the good chairman was referring to. A committee of the whole amendment, and I would move the committee of the whole amendment number 1 to Senate File 83 and ask for the body's favorable consideration. This amendment basically addresses the punishment part of the criminal remedy.
Senator Peterson, I'd like to have the reader read that in, please.
Thank you.
Senate File 83, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 11 through lines 10 through 24.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Peterson.
This amendment basically is addressing the issue that we had as the committee. We were discussing the punishment side of the criminal remedy. And the challenge, Mr. Chairman, was basically, as we talk about Medicaid fraud and Medicaid claims in general, it's such a widespread number of claims and the value of these claims. You're talking about anywhere between $2.50 claim to a $10,000 claim. And so as we wrestled and tugged with this basic problem of trying to address these claims under one umbrella, a couple of options were discussed, and we felt that this option would probably be the best. The good senator from here in Cheyenne put her head together and came up with this solution. I think it's a good solution and addresses the problem that we were struggling with. Basically, it covers two areas, a felony and a misdemeanor. And we came up with the idea, Mr. Chairman, of using a percentage. And I'll just go ahead and read that under line 10. A felony punishable by imprisonment for not more than 10 years, a fine of not more than $10,000, or both. And here's the catch. If the medical assistance claimed for, which records were not maintained, equals 25% or more of the Medicaid claims submitted by the person in the same three-month period. So there's two items on here, 25% or more. Again, we're talking about a felony charge. And then it had to be a defined period, and so we came up with the 3 months. The second, a misdemeanor. Now we're talking about a misdemeanor for those smaller claims. If the medical assistance claim for which records were not maintained equals more than 10%, so it has a floor, but less than 25%, which would be the ceiling of this misdemeanor charge, of the Medicaid claim submitted by the person in the same three-month period. So this amendment, Mr. Chairman, addresses that problem as we talk about the criminal remedy of this bill. Basically, I think it's a fair amendment. It certainly is a friendly amendment that addresses the heartburn that a lot of our professionals were struggling with. In the original bill, it was $500. And as you think about our professional, licensed professionals, doctors, dentists, others, a lot of times they don't pick up a stethoscope for less than $500. So the concern was we're making felons out of doctors for $500 or just over that as far as Medicaid claims, and it could have been done innocently. So we wanted to rectify that, Mr. Chairman, and that's why this amendment came forth, and I appreciate the good work of the committee and the committee members, and I would ask for your favorable consideration on Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 83.
Ready for the question? Question. All those in favor of Senator Peterson's Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 83, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll again be brief and apologize to the good body for having to retrace this ground again and replow it, but it is an important bill. The reason I bring the bill is Medicaid fraud is prevalent throughout this good nation of ours and as well as in our own state here. They estimate that 3 to 10% of all Medicaid claims are fraudulent claims, and that in Wyoming means out of our $508 million budget for Medicaid, if we just figure 3%, that's $15 million in savings, or if we go after that and retrieve those, the $15 million that we get back if we find that there's a reason to prosecute and fine these providers. I handed out, we had handed out a sheet yesterday, or Friday, excuse me, of, it's called this fact sheet on Senate File 83, Medicaid Fraud Recovery. It covers some highlights and some points. Just briefly, I'll review these just to remind the body of the importance of this legislation. In this basic bill, we cover the civil remedy, and then we also address the criminal remedy. The civil remedy will allow us basically to receive up to treble damages and penalties to repay the Medicaid for both loss and the cost of the fraud investigation. Just a reminder, at present we are operating in Wyoming under the Federal False Claims Act, which basically means that in our AG's office we have a Medicaid fraud division consisting of one attorney, one assistant, and two staff people. That's our Medicaid fraud division for our great state of Wyoming. They are charged with investigation of fraudulent claims when it comes to their attention. As we are operating under the Federal False Claims Act, we have somewhat our hands tied behind our back in the fact that everything has to be initiated by the feds. Any investigation within the state of Wyoming or at Howell has to be done under that Federal False Claims Act. In other words, if there is a false claims submitted and our office wants to investigate, they do it under the guise of the Federal False Claims Act. And if the federal agencies do not want to participate and pull out, then we pull out. For example, if they figure that the false claim is too minimal, it's not worth the time, they pull out and thus forcing us to pull out. So that is the importance of this bill, is to have our own False Claims Act, and specifically in regards to Medicaid claims. Number two, a criminal statute that has some teeth, and it does. Again, we're trying to go after those that are continual perpetual fraudulent claims that seem to be happening on a reoccurring basis with some of our providers. And if we can prove that it's on a reoccurring basis, then the criminal part of this bill comes into play. Senate File 83 includes a detailed explanation of the legal terms knowing and knowingly, which increase the state's ability to recover damages and create state penalties for Medicaid fraud that are in line with the existing Wyoming larceny statutes. It also gives us an effective tool dealing with entities it does not want to prosecute. It would be in our purview and our best interest sometimes that our AG's office do not prosecute, that rather would take the avenue of working with these providers such as nursing homes, hospitals. The intent of this bill is not to shut down these providers, but simply take care of the problem and prevent fraud and to try to keep our Medicaid budget whole as much as we possibly can. These treble damages in the civil remedy, they certainly would have a deterring effect on providers who are contemplating breaking the law. And it's been mentioned in previous testimonies in years past that Medicaid is quite a complicated thing for providers to participate in. And I believe the reimbursement's like 60 cents on the dollar. And so these providers are struggling with the attitude or decision whether to participate with Medicaid at all. And this bill is not, and I can repeat, not an effort to try to make it more complicated, deterring our providers from participating in Medicaid. That's not the intent of this bill at all. The intent, again, is basically to make Medicaid whole by going after some of these fraudulent claims and not prosecuting, but rather just getting that money back that has been taken from the state with Medicaid false claims. Down at the bottom of that fact sheet, suing a provider only takes place when there is a clear and repeated violation of the law. That's the only time that we would probably use the criminal aspect of this bill, is if there was repeated violations, and rightfully so. The bill itself is, like I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, it's an old friend, and it's the language is the same with the civil penalties and the criminal penalties. It's important that we address this. This body's been favorable before on this particular bill. It is an old friend of this body's. We seem to have struggled with the other end of the building here, but we'll try to take it back if passed here, Mr. Chairman, and get it right over there and get this on its way. I'd stand for any questions. Thank you.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm just struggling with one point. I like the bill overall, and I liked it last time also. But with regard to the State Government Fraud Reduction Act, is there a requirement that we have a felony penalty as opposed to, for example, a high misdemeanor under 42411E, Romanet I? I'm just trying to grapple with the concept of somebody mismanaging records, which is basically what's here. There's not even any intent to defraud or anything else. We're just saying a person who fails to maintain records in accordance with Medicaid program rules and requirements for medical assistance is guilty of. And then we've just changed it so if they have a 25% problem, they could have a 10-year prison term, felony conviction, and $10,000 fine. Is that justifiable? I mean, what type of scenario would we really want to put them away for 10 years to protect the public from somebody who didn't do a good job with Medicaid records, even if it is in a fraudulent fashion? So I'd like to hear from the sponsors of the bill whether or not a high misdemeanor would suffice in this situation or whether we truly need a felony.
Senator Nutting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just respond to the question about, is this really a felony problem when it's really a problem of record keeping? Of course, that percentage of claims is a financial amount, and it can result in 25% of that financial claim can be a large amount of money, and the taxpayers are thereby defrauded of a significant amount of money. But the crime goes even beyond that, in that if someone claims that and bills for having provided certain services, sometimes it's over a long period of time that they are making claims for, that they maybe have seen somebody three times a week, and in fact they haven't, but they submit the financial claim for it, then not only is it a bookkeeping problem, but that recipient also then is not receiving those services that are being billed. And sometimes those services mean a great difference in morbidity and sometimes even in mortality. So I think it is a felony-level offense when it is done to that high level, because not only is it a large amount of financial defrauding of us, the taxpayers, but it could mean somebody's life if they're not receiving those services that they were supposed to be.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I'd add to that because that was my instinct, was that it ought to be a high misdemeanor. The testimony we had in committee was that typically where you've got a real fraud going on, you can't prove that it's a fraud because they don't keep any records, and that makes it much more difficult to prove the fraud. So one of the earmarks of a real fraud is they don't have the records, so you've got to make not having the records a crime as well as committing the fraud in order to catch the people that are doing the fraud and get a conviction. Because on an audit, they really depend on the records, and if somebody's just not bothering to keep records, it gets to be fairly difficult to prove that there was a fraud. So that's why you do have a felony penalty in both cases. I do have some reservations about felony as opposed to high misdemeanor, but there is no requirement that it be a felony. And this is really in addition to the civil penalties. In most cases, the civil penalties and the recovery is what you're after. and it's appropriate to have a civil penalty because you, if they've been doing some fraud, they've probably been doing some other in a time period where you haven't got it. But you, where you go for the criminal thing, really the earmarks of the crime are the first thing, you don't keep records.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, that felony was already in 42.4.111. We didn't change that. We tried to make it a little softer because we heard from the medical society that that was a little strong, and so we're just modifying what was already in the statutes.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And another response. We had the same heartburn over this. Of the criminal penalty here. This False Claims Act, to be approved and accepted by our federal counterparts, has to meet certain requirements to be a legitimate False Claims Act, and this was one of those requirements. And it's different among all states. Some of the states, for example, Oklahoma has a definition, any person who violates paragraph 7 of subsection A of section of this time or this title shall be guilty of a felony. Arkansas, any person found not having maintained any records is guilty of a Class D felony if unavailability of records impairs or obstructs the prosecution of a felony. Otherwise, the unavailability of records is a Class A misdemeanor. So it's widespread, depending on how serious the state wants to take it. But if we submit this and it is approved, because remember that the feds participate 50% with our Medicaid claims, because they're a 50% stakeholder, they have some say on what our false claims, what kind of false claims we're going after. And so they have to approve this False Claims Act. And if it meets their requirements, then we get an extra 10% bump on our reimbursements. So we are, I believe, one of eight states that do not presently have a False Claims Act. Everybody else does. Except for the eight, and we're one of the eight that presently does not have a False Claims Act, not receiving the extra 10% on reimbursements for false claims made.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I still have the same heartburn. I appreciate the responses from my good colleagues, but when you convict somebody of a felony, you take away a lot of their rights. It's nearly impossible to get back those rights. We have some provisions now that allow you to get those back. 10 years in prison is an awful long time. Even if we were to strengthen this to the point where they were actually clearly guilty of a crime, which would be the fraud, as opposed to evidence of a crime, which would be not keeping records, which, as we heard in testimony, is a good indication that you might be committing a crime. So we've tagged a felony, if this piece of legislation passes, on what is effectively an indication that a crime may have been committed. That might be a little bit strong. Again, even 10 years might be too strong if there was clear evidence of fraud and you had an absolute conviction. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that we need to seriously consider as a body whether or not we want this to be a high misdemeanor or a felony. I'd potentially encourage amendments. I might bring one for the second reading, but I'm still not convinced yet. I'd be interested in hearing more debate or just looking towards it for the second reading tomorrow.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was also asked, because we had that same heartburn of this part of the bill, how many providers we have in the state and how many have been brought up on civil charges to try to get this remedy and try to get some of these monies back. 9,800 providers, 15 fines have been imposed, and out of those 15 fines, then the question was asked, how many were professional licensed providers? And I believe the answer was one. So, and this is again acting under the present False Claims Act under the federal umbrella. So keep that in mind as well. But again, the intent, and I understand the concern, the heartburn, the language we want to get it right. But the intent of this bill is to just make Medicaid whole, going after providers. They do a lot of retraining through the Department of our Department of Health and the AG's office on Medicaid. The rules are very clear and very explicit on what they need to do to provide a claim or to submit a claim. These providers, whether it be a nursing home, hospital, doctors, dentists, eye doctors, anybody claiming Medicaid reimbursement, they know and they've been instructed or what how the program works, and they've put their name on the line. Now, whether these claims are done deliberately, wrongfully, or innocently, the end result is it's been overbilled, and the claims have been submitted false. So this bill tries to address that. The other thing I would point out, Mr. Chairman, is that we just seem to keep throwing money at a big, deep, dark hole, and it's not going to get any better. The baby boomers are here. They're upon us. It's like that big bulge going through that snake. It was joked about that in the good state of Florida, you can't throw a rock without hitting a false Medicaid filing. So it's here. It's something that we need to address. We could do a better job at it, but I am not one to keep voting in increases in the Medicaid in the Department of Health budget when we can't do a very good job of watching our dimes and pennies and dollars with some of our false claims that are being submitted. And it is happening here in Wyoming. If this penalty in the criminal aspect is too stiff and we want to make it a misdemeanor, that's fine. But I would urge the body to reconsider, understanding the intent of this is not to make doctors felons, but rather to put some teeth into a bill that would prevent doctors and hospitals and nursing homes to overbill on these fraudulent claims. And it does happen. And as I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, for the reasons of right now, it's a reimbursement of 60 cents on the dollar. Some justify it that I'm going to get that 40 cents back some way, one way or another. And the attitude is it's really not hurting anybody. It's we've got the money. So, but it is, because what happens, and I think I brought this up as we talked about this last time, was that there are names and faces attached to coming short on Medicaid funds. When the money runs out, the waiting list is there. Benefits are reduced or eliminated completely. There was one gentleman back in New Jersey who had used up his full year, 12-month benefits in 6 months because of the service provider that was rendering the services to this person was overbilling. And so at the end of the 6 months period, his allotment was up and gone. He was on a respirator. And when he was notified from the State Department that his funds were all tapped and used up, and he still had 6 months to go. So it's not a faceless crime. There are faces involved. There are people when money comes up short, and we'll face this in our great state here too. It's a serious crime, something that we need to get a better handle on. Mr. Chairman, I'd urge the body support as it sits.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question as I was pondering this as I was going through. I happen to represent several physicians. Not many of them are independent anymore because they're all getting bought up by the hospital. But those that are many times use outside services to do their billing for them. And I'm just wondering how that plays in. I have a client that was wondering why he wasn't making any money and realized that the service that was billing for him wasn't doing a very good job. Now, in that situation, is he responsible if for some reason the billing service bills Medicaid for things that he didn't know that they were billing for? Who's responsible? Is this act big enough to catch that billing service rather than the doctor? Or is the doctor, because his name's on the line, ultimately guilty of a felony?
Senator Escobel.
Mr. Chairman, I share some of the concerns that have been mentioned over here, and I think it's outrageous that some individuals would take advantage of that segment of the population that is in need of these services, but in terms of throwing money down the dark hole, as the good senator mentioned, and I just wonder if we might be doing ourselves more harm than good by having that felony provision in there, because get somebody sent up to prison on a felony for 10 years, the state would be paying for those medical costs anyway, plus the upkeep for that individual, which I understand is around approximately $50,000 a year to keep somebody in one of our correctional institutes. So you put $50,000 on top of whatever medical costs the state has to put forward for their care. It gets to be a fair amount of change. So I think maybe you might want to reconsider that felony provision. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to the previous question, the statute, the basic fraud statute that you find, it's not reprinted in the bill, but it's 42.4.111, somebody has to do something knowingly. And, Mr. Chairman, unless a physician was knowingly not telling or telling his billing service that he'd done a bunch of things that he hadn't, and they could prove that he'd done it knowing that he did it, he's fine. He may get his claims denied, but he's fine. And, Mr. Chairman, and that's important, don't get sidetracked too much as we try to get the criminal penalties, which apparently are at some level required by the feds. We try to get them squared around here. This is an important part of the effort, and this is, I think, the first of many bills we're going to see trying to bring our Medicaid program costs under control, Mr. Chairman. This is an important part of it. We had testimony in committee, Mr. Chairman, that using the Federal False Claims Act, as we now have to, is not effective, and you heard some discussion as to why it's not effective. We don't know the real level of the fraud, Medicaid fraud, in this state. The best evidence I've seen really related to the Medicare fraud, an article published in the Forbes magazine, and it said typically with private insurance in the healthcare area, the fraud rate, they spend about 3% of their administrative costs trying to combat fraud. The fraud rate they get is about a half of 1%. Now, a half of 1%, big money, not as big as Medicaid. In Medicare, which is the federal program perhaps most similar to Medicaid, they spend a half of 1% administratively trying to pursue fraud, and they get a 10% fraud rate. I don't think the fraud rate in Wyoming is anywhere near that. Mr. Chairman, in our smaller communities, you just don't do that sort of thing near as much. But I expect if they have a working Wyoming False Claims Act and they get vigorous about it, they're going to find considerably more than they have under the current circumstances dealing with the feds. I expect there's a good deal more out there. You think of how complex hospital bills are, and I think a vigorous look at some of that, you're going to recover some real money. I expect, Mr. Chairman, that's where some of the real money is here. I don't really foresee criminal prosecutions, but I do see significantly more recovery, and once you see significantly more recovery, then your rate of problem is going to go down, so you're going to save a good deal more, Mr. Chairman, than you actually recover. So I strongly commend this bill to the Senate.
Question has been called for. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the committee of the whole rise to report to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 83. Those say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 83, the Heartburn Creation Bill, has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 87.
Senate File 87, Proof of Motor Vehicle Insurance, sponsored by Senator Scott, and Act Relating to Motor Vehicle Insurance. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highway, Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cooper, Escobel, Landon, Schiffer, Von Fladren, Senator Von Fladren, Chairman.
Senator Von Fladren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass on Senate File 87. There is an amendment. I ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 87, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 87, and to explain this fine little bill, I would ask you to recognize a tall senator from Natrona County.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me start out with the Standing Committee Amendment because I don't think it's controversial. What it does is it removes on page 3, lines 15 and 16, this is a verification system. You need one to make this bill work. We've had it up and running for 4 years now. Works just fine. And so you don't, having it referenced again, the bill caused some confusion amongst the lobby, and you don't need it. So the Standing Committee elected to simply take the section out. The other thing they do is correct a statutory reference. The reference that's there is not incorrect, but the one that's there leads you to another section that re-refers to 318201, so you don't, it's better to do it just directly. So that's all the Standing Committee Amendment does, Mr. Chairman. I hope we would adopt it.
Question's been called for. All in favor of Senator Von Flader's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Number 1 of Senate File 87, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment is passed. Back on the bill, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, what this bill is all about is, I'm sure all the senators are familiar with the identification cards that we now have to carry to show that we have the required minimum liability insurance. And you get stopped by the highway patrol or the police, you have to produce that card and show it. If you have an accident, you have to show it so that in exchange insurance information. So that card is something we're all familiar with. Turns out that in this electronic age, a number of the insurance companies, Mr. Chairman, have developed electronic apps that can give you, on the modern iPhones and iPads and that sort of thing, an electronic copy of that card so that you've got the proof electronically. And, Mr. Chairman, a number of people are carrying it that way. What happened was that one of the insurance agents was using such a card for his personal liability insurance. He's proved that he's got it. Got stopped by a highway patrolman who said electronic isn't good enough, it has to be written, and gave him a ticket. And the agent complained to the president of the Association of Wyoming Insurance Agents, which is, that's the outfit that's putting on that shrimp bash tonight. And agent complained to the president of that organization, and she complained to me, and I said, well, let's look at the statute, and if you read the statute carefully, Mr. Chairman, the patrolman was, he was being perhaps overly zealous and strict, but he was correct on the letter of the law. Electronic isn't good enough. And, Mr. Chairman, that's what this bill does. It makes the electronic form good enough. And you'll see on page 2, line 8, we knock out, says, now it says show written proof. We say just show proof. And then on page 3, you get the heart of the bill. Identification card may be issued in electronic form. if the insured and the insurer both agree. And that's important, Mr. Chairman, because you have particularly a number of small fleets where you'll have people driving it that don't have these electronic cards. They're still going to need them in the paper form. And the electronic card contains the information that the paper card has got to contain. So it's a simple bill, Mr. Chairman. I think it's in part an age thing. Some people like me are probably going to continue to carry the paper card. I noticed over in the House when I went over hunting co-sponsors, I got a father and son combination, and Dad said, "What's that?" And son said, "Oh, that's the way I carry it. I mean, it isn't legal." I think we're going to see that kind of an age division in the actual use of these things. So, Mr. Chairman, this is a good little bill that will help us come into the modern electronic age and make it easier, particularly for the younger generation, to comply with the law. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question's been called for. All those in favor of Senator Von Flatter's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 87, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 87 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 39.
Senate File 39, Uniform Adult Guardianship Jurisdiction Act, sponsored by Senator Ross, an act relating to guardianship and conservators. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 39, Uniform Adult Guardianship Jurisdiction Act. And Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 39, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the standing committee amendment as well. And would request that we recognize the Senate President, President Ross, to walk us through this good little bill.
Mr. President.
Well, it's not little, Mr. Chairman, but it is an important bill, and I think an effective bill. With regard to the Standing Committee Amendment, which has been moved already, most of it is cleanup language on page one, you see where they left out the word jurisdiction, and then throughout, down through line 25, is all about changing the word from incapacitated to incompetent or incompetency, which comports with our current guardianship statutes. And then we add in some reporting that's already required in our guardianship statutes as it is right now. So I will kind of walk you through as we go through with that amendment, but that's the gist of that amendment, and I think it works well. Just let me tell you, you probably received an orange folder with a number of different documents pertaining to this bill. And it is a bill that is being brought to you on behalf of what we have in Wyoming as an aging population and throughout the United States, and a mobile society in which we're finding more and more of our children taking care of their grandparents or others or brothers and sisters taking care of each other as they become incompetent or incapacitated. This bill is a uniform law commissioner's bill, which every state participates in as a uniform law. Our commissioner has reviewed the bill, happens to be our deputy auditor. Vicki Colgan approves it. It's also approved by the American Bar Association. and the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. What this bill does is doesn't change the format, the framework, or anything with regards to guardianships or conservatorships, but what it does is it establishes a mechanism for determining amongst the states who has jurisdiction. And it is really patterned almost after the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act. Many of you that were here when I first came into the Senate will recall when I first came in, I carried the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act, which dealt with which states have jurisdiction when we're talking about custody cases. Well, what this bill does is very much the same thing. It talks about a mechanism for how and which states have jurisdiction when we're dealing with guardianships or conservatorships, and I'll explain the difference to you in just a second, which state will have jurisdiction. Now, a guardianship in Wyoming, we refer to them as two things, a guardianship over the person, or you can have a guardianship over the person and their property. And many times they're joined together. Sometimes we have what's called a conservatorship, which is where an individual is a conservator for taking care of the respondent's assets and maintaining their bank accounts and so forth and making sure that they're paying for appropriately the adult that is in need of a conservator. Most often, more often than not, you see those things joined. You see them as a guardianship and a conservatorship. But you can have situations where an individual is physically incapacitated, but their mind is pretty good. They may just simply need a guardianship over the person. Sometimes it's the exact opposite. They're fairly mobile and whatnot, but they have dementia or whatever else, and they need somebody to manage their personal affairs.
Thank you.
Welcome. In any event, what this bill does then is it sets up the same mechanism that's in the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act. What it does, it creates a new article, Article 8, within Title 3, which is our guardianship and conservatorship statutes, and sets up a jurisdictional framework so that the courts in the United States have a framework from which to work to decide which court is best able to handle the case. If there is a map that was in your packet, and it shows all of the states around us, there's Wyoming, all of the states around us have this Uniform Act. So it's about 35 states, as I recall, plus Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia. So I really don't want to have to walk you through each page, or we'll be here forever, but the first chapter, Article 1, is it sets up the definitions, and you'll see that we walk through, and let me just tell you, where we start changing the word incapacitated to incompetent, The Uniform Act uses the word incapacitated, but our current guardianship and conservatorship statutes uses the word incompetent, and so what we've decided to maintain that they stay the terms similar. I just want to read you in currently in our guardian statutes what incompetent person means. It means an individual who, for reasons other than being a minor, is unable, unassisted to properly manage and take care of himself or his property as a result of medical conditions of advanced age, physical disability, disease, use of alcohol, controlled substances, mental illness, mental deficiency, or intellectual disability. So it really does go with the concept of being incapacitated. So those first 25 lines on the Standing Committee Amendment, that's all that deals with. When you have a guardianship and or a conservatorship, There are certain reporting requirements that are already in the statutes that require that the conservator or the guardian file reports with the court generally on an annual basis. And those reports are important because then the court knows how and the person's being managed and how his funds are being managed. Remember that if, as a guardian or as a conservator, you have certain fiduciary duties. And those fiduciary duties require that you act as a reasonable person at a reasonable time and place. And on behalf of that individual, act as if you were reasonable in your own affairs. So that reporting on page 25, line 18, paragraph J, just incorporates that reporting there, and on page 27, also incorporates reporting on page 27. That is the Standing Committee Amendment. I'd ask for any questions, first of all, on the Standing Committee Amendment, and then I can kind of march you through the bill a little bit.
Question's been called for. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 39, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment has passed. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Article 1 sets up the definitions on page 2 and 3, and you'll see that I think I pretty much explained. These are for adults, folks, so it's anybody over the age of 18. And as I said, you'll see that on page 4, the definition of a respondent, we refer to the person that's in need of a guardianship or a conservatorship as the respondent, and he's an adult or she is, for whom a protective order or an appointment of a guardian is sought. I want to specifically point out, and this is a very important sections, 38104 and 38105 are kind of the crux of how even the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act. It requires this act, as does the UCCJEA, requires that the court communicate with each other. It requires the courts in various jurisdictions to cooperate with each other, and it sets up a list on page 6 of the various kinds of cooperation things that are required under this Uniform Act, so that you can have situations where you could have property that's in one state and the respondent being in another state, and you need to have some hearings about their property or whatever. Those can go on through cooperation within the court. So, for instance, you can hold on page 6, you can have evidentiary hearings, or you can take testimony from other outside the state, or procedures if, in fact, for instance, there may be a need to have the respondent evaluated, how that can occur amongst the states. And then forwarding and copying each other's state with transcripts and records to assure that they have the appropriate information to make an appropriate determination concerning the best interest of the respondent. On page 7 in subparagraph B is deals with the same request from another state to us in this state. Also provides on page 7 with regards to taking testimony in another state. And that can be done on page 8 by telephone or other means, audiovisual, electronic means. And then on page lines 14 and 15 on page 8, it doesn't, because we're using electronic age and whatnot, there is a rule in law called the best evidence rule. And so let's assume that you had some sort of evidentiary proceeding in Kansas, and now there's another similar thing going on in Wyoming. They can electronically or whatever submit that, and you don't have to have the original to be determined for the best interest or best evidence rule. Article 2 is the crux of it, which is the jurisdiction, 38201. And there are basically three kinds of jurisdiction that you can have. The most important is in Romanet 2, which is the home state. And the home state is defined exactly like it is in the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act. You look at where the respondent resided for at least 6 months prior to filing the petition for a guardianship or conservatorship. That's the key. But there are also other kinds of jurisdictions that you could have. You could have in Romanet I, above that, one, emergency jurisdiction, when there's a potential for substantial harm to the respondent's health or safety or welfare. So we sometimes we have, and you'll see in some of those materials, that a thing called granny snatching. Well, the mom will go to son's house in Kansas for Christmas, and then ends up staying there because they want her money, and the other siblings are still here in Wyoming, and you're trying to figure out which state has jurisdiction. You could have an emergency jurisdiction hearing, depending on where the situation lies. The other thing that you can have is a significant connection jurisdiction, which is in Romanet 3, where Wyoming isn't the home state of the child, of the adult, but there are all kinds of other evidence that is maybe the very best place to hear the case, even though the adult is in Kansas. So the court can determine whether or not there's substantial evidence and communicate and cooperate with each other to determine which state really has the more significant connection to this respondent. On page 10, there's a whole list of what is considered to be significant connections, such as the location of the respondent's family, the length of time the respondent is in a particular state or not, location of his property, and the extent to which the respondent has ties to one state, such as voting, registration, so forth. So that's there. I forgot something? We're not repeating that. You would do that. This is serious now. I should have said grandpa snatching, but
Senator Ross, do you wish a recess?
No. Okay. Where am I? Jurisdiction. Page 11. The state is the court of this state has jurisdiction to appoint a guardian or issue a protective order if it's the home state on the date the petition is filed has significant connection to the state, or if states can decline jurisdiction. So a lot of times you can have states that say, you know, I think it's best that it be heard in Wyoming or vice versa. That's all explained on jurisdiction 38203. Then you have situations where you could have where Wyoming is the home state, but on page 11, a petition for appointment has not been filed or in the home state, and there's no objection elsewhere. So all of that is important in trying to decipher which court has the best jurisdiction. Special jurisdiction. With regard to special jurisdiction, the appointment of a guardian in an emergency would generally only be for a period of 90 days, and then the court must have some sort of hearing to determine whether or not to continue with that emergency jurisdiction or transfer the case, and there's further definitions in the back of the bill with regards to transferring the case. One of the things that's also important in this bill is that if you were the original court of jurisdiction and you issued an order with regards to a guardianship, 38205 means that you still retain exclusive jurisdiction until either the guardianship is terminated or expires on its own terms, or if, as we get further on in the bill, there's a transfer to another state. With regards to what is an appropriate forum, you can look on page 15, and these are factors for an appropriate forum, where should the case physically reside. Even if Wyoming has jurisdiction, it may still be important that it be in Laramie County versus Carbon County or something of that nature. So they look at the express preference of the respondent, whether or not there's abuse and neglect and where that may have occurred, or the length of time, once again, where the individual may resided, distance from the court, all of those kinds of things, financial circumstances of the estate, and the nature and location of evidence. On page 16, we have what is called jurisdiction decline by reason of conduct. And this gives the court the ability to decline jurisdiction if for some reason there's unjustifiable conduct, particularly on the part of family members or the person who may be seeking a guardianship or conservatorship in this state. And they can decline it. And then there are, if the court determines that there was unjustifiable conduct, can stay the proceeding and then ask for a court of another jurisdiction to take over. It can also, on page 18, assess fees, attorney's fees, expenses, investigative fees, communication expenses, witness fees, and expenses and travel expenses. All of that is the court may do if it finds that this thing was a ruse or that there was unjustifiable conduct. Notice. Big deal. It's important. Notice is in 38208. Everybody's got to get notice. You got to get notice if you're in the state of Wyoming, and it provides for notice outside of the state. So you look to family members and all that may be required to have notice, and that's provided in 38208. If we go over to Article 3 of this, that's the transfer of the guardianship and conservatorships. And basically, this is a mechanism to allow for transfer between states. It's important because right now there is no mechanism in Wyoming. If you wanted to, let's say there's a guardianship in Kansas and dad has now moved to Wyoming, there is no mechanism to simply transfer that. You have to open up a new guardianship in Wyoming. This will allow for that transfer, or it allows for a transfer back out of this state, and it also saves everybody money because you don't have to go through a whole new proceeding. You can just simply transfer it. You can also, pursuant to Article 3, register a foreign order in this state. And then if need be, if there was needed to be some sort of testimony or something else, you have the ability to do that without having to open up a whole nother guardianship or conservatorship in the state of Wyoming or outside the state. Of importance in looking at this, though, is on page 22, and I think that this is always important, or on page 21 and 22, specifically plans. The court must look for at plans for care and services for the incompetent person in another state are reasonable and sufficient. And so one of the things you need to make sure is that the court is capable of adequately supervising and making sure that this person is being taken care of. And that's generally done in the home state and the jurisdiction which is closest to them. But on page 22, it also makes, the court has to look at making sure that their arrangements are made for the management and protection of the person's property. That's for conservatorships. So I think I've pretty much walked you through the basics of the bill. One of the things that that I have no idea what this is about, as I mentioned in committee, this Uniform Act has a provision 38502, which is relation to electronic signatures in the Global and National Commerce Act. I don't know what that is, but apparently there's a federal act to that, and this provision says that this act modifies and limits and supersedes the Electronic Signatures Global and National Commerce Act. One of the things that's also important is that the guardian or the conservator, if they're going to do this, they personally submit themselves to the jurisdiction of this court. That's the bill. It's a mechanism. I can tell you firsthand with regards to the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act that has worked amazingly well. And it's something that I've kind of developed a niche in my law practice of multi-state litigation involving child custody, and it's worked tremendously well. I think it'll work really well here, and I urge your favorable consideration.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, and if the President, it's kind of a technical one, but I've had some experience with it, and it's about the international application of the Act, and I think it's under 38103. It says that they may treat a foreign country as a state, and the question I have, and when they do that, they exclude number 4 of your articles, which talks about the registration of it, and my question is, Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman, for President Ross, is how do you reconcile that, the fact that you do not register it? Is there a mechanism in place to do that? Because in the experience I had, there was kind of a disconnect there. And I'm just, when it happened with Canada, which is a sort of a sister state. And I don't need a direct answer right now because that's too technical, but I'm just concerned how that might work.
Mr. President.
Good question. I'm not real certain on the registration portion. Try to get an answer with regards to that. But what this basically says in that article is that we may treat a foreign country as if it's a state for purposes of Articles 2, 3, and 5 of this Act. I'll try to make, Article 2 is jurisdiction. Article 3, of course, is, where is it? Transfer, and then registration is not in there. But Article 5 is. I think basically, probably the answer ultimately is that there may be different requirements with regards to registration versus transferring a case. Registration doesn't mean that necessarily the whole case moves to the state of Wyoming or vice versa. It's just simply filed in the other state because there may be ancillary things that are going on that do not require necessary full-blown guardianship or so forth.
Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 39, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 39 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 19.
Senate File 19, Hospital District Elections, sponsored by Senator Geis, an act relating to special hospital districts. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Nutting, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do-pass recommendation on Senate File 19. Mr. Chairman, there's also a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 19, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 2.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the standing committee amendment to Senate File 19. I would yield to the bill sponsor if he wants to say a few words, or I could just go ahead. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, this is a bill about hospital district elections. Mr. Chairman, currently in our current law, hospital districts are required to conform to or a petition for the formation of a hospital district is required to conform to the requirement that it receive a certain number of signatures from voters and a certain number of signatures from the landowners or the owners of the assessed valuation, Mr. Chairman. What this bill does is removes the requirement that the you get the signatures of the assessed valuation, and what it allows is for the Board of County Commissioners to put the vote for formation directly to the voters and removes the landowners or assessed valuation holders from the equation. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I know that the good sponsor from Washakie County can explain the particular situation that brought this forward. He happens to represent really the only two districts in the state affected by this.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I'm bringing this, we have 14 hospitals that have districts in the state of Wyoming. We have 8 county hospitals, and then we have 8 for-profit hospitals in the state of Wyoming. I happen to have 2 hospitals in Washoe County and Hot Springs County that are county hospitals, and they would like to form a district, and that's why I brought this bill, and I'm sure there's other hospitals around the state that might follow suit too. But anyway, I think under the tight money and all that, why we need to go to the voters at the local level and see if they want to tax themselves to run their hospitals. And that's all this bill does, is allow the county commissioners to do that. And I'd yield the floor to Senator Scott to explain the standing committee amendments.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, has the standing committee amendment been read in and moved?
It has, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, standing committee amendment, and I guess I'm explaining it because I'm the guilty party in committee. When you look at the language that's eliminated at the bottom of page 1, it divorced this from the Special District Election Act, and it turns out that where you need to do that for the formation purposes, that act should govern subsequent elections for the hospital district. And what the standing committee amendment does is put that provision back in as a new 3i, and a subsequent election for the special hospital district shall be had as provided by. And that's all the standing committee amendment does. It was, I think, the drafters focused on the problem with the initial formation and missed that act was going to cover the subsequent election, so you can, when you elect new trustees, as you regularly do, Mr. Chairman. So that's what the Standing Committee Amendment does, and I urge its adoption.
Ready for the question? Question having been called for, all those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 19, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That amendment has passed. We are back on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly on this bill, and it's not my bill, but, and I first saw it after it had been filed, but, Mr. Chairman, this is an important measure. This is, I think, the second measure we've hit trying to deal with the probable effects of the national health reform. We think there's going to be considerable pressure on reimbursements for hospitals, and that it may well cost us some of our small hospitals in the state. And the testimony we had in committee was that just under half of the hospitals are already hospital districts and can levy a mill levy, and this would enable other hospitals to get there. The problem they're having is that a majority of the assessed valuation is held by large out-of-state companies who could care less and won't sign any petitions. So you have to give the county commissioners authority if you want to have an election and have a special district. And this may well be the mechanism that in the next few years enables us to save a number of the small, particularly critical access hospitals around the state. And there, we really do expect there's going to be quite a bit of pressure on their reimbursements, both from Medicare as they seek and from in the subsidized insurance through the exchanges as the feds seek to tame the cost monster they've created. So this is an important measure for a number of our communities, and I would strongly urge its adoption by the Senate.
Senator Dockstetter.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's important that we open up an opportunity for our county hospitals to move into a district. Let me just give you a little example of what we did with a district over in our valley about 7-8 years ago. We had a situation with about 3 docs, and we were nothing short of a hospital clinic. And using a district, we built a new hospital. And now here we are about 8 years later, and we've got 2 general surgeons working out of 2 state-of-the-art surgical suites that would compete with anything in Cheyenne or Casper. We got 2 orthopedic surgeons. We got 8 family practitioners. And we got a variety of specialists who fly in to take care of their work in those surgical suites. Let me tell you, a district opens up a lot of opportunity when it comes to health care in a rural area.
Question having been called for, all those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 19, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 19 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 37. Mike, please.
Senate File 37, Office of Consumer Advocate Revisions 2, sponsored by Senator Case, an act relating to public utilities. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Nutting, and Scott. No, Senator Johnson, Senator Hines, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 37. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 37, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 1.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, during the course of this interim, we held hearings on the sunset bill that we heard earlier about the Office of the Consumer Advocate. The Committee of the Whole approved that bill a little bit earlier today. That was Senate File 6. In the course of that investigation about that sunset date, we learned from the Public Service Commission that the consumer advocate does not appear in all the cases, and that occasionally we have had cases before the Wyoming Public Service Commission where no one has testified on behalf of consumers of the state of Wyoming in official capacity, Mr. Chairman. So I brought this bill to remedy that, Mr. Chairman. It was kind of brought as a substitute bill for the earlier bill that we passed this morning, but with the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman, it has been amended to fit fine with the bill as we passed. And, Mr. Chairman, the gist of this is that it allows, in the cases where the consumer advocate does not participate, it allows the Public Service Commission staff to participate and provide expert witness services in the case as a party, just like the consumer advocate would do, but since the consumer advocate's not there, someone has to do it, Mr. Chairman. This is sort of a throwback to the way it used to be done before the Office of Consumer Advocate was created. With the Standing Committee Amendment, as it's put on, it's a very limited situation, and it's only in the case where the consumer advocate has not appeared in the case, meaning there is no one there to advocate for consumers. This allows a staff member to do so. And that's what the Standing Committee Amendment does, Mr. Chairman. I will note also that the staff of the commission are not allowed to appeal the case, Mr. Chairman, in either event, so that they can't become an appellate party. It's limited to that. What this does, Mr. Chairman, is provide a record in those cases where a record may be deficient because of a lack of participation by the consumer advocate. And this is not a judgment on the consumer advocate, Mr. Chairman. It could be that they don't have enough staff members. It could be that they don't think the case is important, but maybe other people do. I suppose there's several reasons, but this does not happen very often. I believe that the chairman of the Public Service Commission testified that it's happened perhaps two, perhaps three times, but they were important times. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Burns.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask the sponsor of the bill on the amendment, which I believe is up before us right now. One of the other things the amendment seems to do is on the bill on page 2, it puts a change in there stating that the administrative head of the division, in other words, the head of the consumer advocate division, shall be subject to Senate confirmation. And as I read the Standing Committee Amendment, it removes that. So I'm wondering if we could get some explanation from the sponsor as to that aspect of the Standing Committee Amendment.
I would be delighted, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, that language about the confirmation is contained in Senate File 6, which went through Committee of the Whole today. This was sort of a duplicate of Senate File 6, with the additional allowance that the PSC staff could testify. But since Senate File 6 passed through the committee, it stands alone, and it has the very language you talk about requiring Senate for confirmation, and I believe it has a sunset date of 2013. You know, so as not to confuse the Senate and bring two bills with the exact same language, we decided to make them stand by themselves. So we eliminated the language about Senate confirmation and the sunset date from this particular bill, so that the only thing that is contained in this bill, if you pass the Standing Committee Amendment, is that the commission staff will be able to participate in these cases when the staff of the consumer advocate does not participate.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Mr. Chairman, I didn't want to bring it up on third reading about the sister bill to this, but the question I have, and this bill's got a good ring to it, but we're extending the sunset date for 10 years. Did you bring to the body some discussion during committee hold about the effectiveness of this? I mean, is there a cost, any kind of a cost analysis done that shows the $2 million we spend a biennium that we receive those kind of benefits? And I know it sounds really good, and I'm sure they've done that, but do you have access to any information like that?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure I didn't get lost in the pronouns, but my understanding is you're asking about the extension of the sunset date on the consumer staff, which is in the other bill and would appropriately been discussed there. But since it is technically at issue in this standing committee amendment, the testimony we had was that the consumer advocate has been very effective in bringing a public perspective to a number of these very complex rate cases. And the testimony was that they are way too complex for individuals to successfully deal with. And even one of the larger lobbying organizations here said, yeah, we did intervene in one, but we had to cut out a whole bunch of things because it would have cost us too much. It's just too complicated. And the consumer advocate has done that job by all testimony very effectively. It does give the Public Service Commission the record that it needs in most of the cases. It is a better mechanism where you have a real contested case to provide an independent look rather than having the commission do it themselves. But there are some cases where the consumer advocate said, you know, it's not a big deal for the consumers here, but it's important for the industry or something, where Public Service Commission needs a better record than it can get under the current circumstances, which is the motivation for this bill. But the other bill, yes, we didn't try to quantitate it or anything like that, but the testimony was over the years that it has been, and that was testimony both in the interim committee and in the standing committee, that it has been a very effective mechanism. And frankly, it was not controversial in either location.
Question having been called for, all those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? We are back on the bill, that amendment having passed. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that you all heard that I voted against this bill in committee for several reasons. One, of course, that the Officer of Consumer Advocate is doing an excellent job. The second one is the reason we created the Office of Consumer Advocate is because the PSC before that was assigning one of their staff or setting up a special staff to act as the consumer advocate, and it really wasn't working very well. I've heard for years how it hadn't worked very well because there was no independence, and it was better that we have an independent office doing that. I think that if the PSC is allowed to appoint somebody for the consumer advocacy, my first question would be, why isn't the consumer advocate doing it? Number one, not enough people, or number two, it really doesn't need to be done. It is a good case for the consumers. So rather than repeat our past sins and keep it the way it is, I would ask you to vote no on this, and if the reason the consumer advocate truly isn't doing all of them is they don't have the bodies, then they could ask for more bodies in the budget section or the appropriations committee, in its wisdom, can transfer a position from PSC over to consumer advocate.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I am a co-sponsor on this bill. That's all very fine, but the testimony we had in the interim committee was the Office of Consumer Advocate does set some priorities and concentrate, Mr. Chairman, on the items where they think the consumer has the most at stake, because they are, that's what they're supposed to do. But there have been, and there's a lot of cases that are just routine, that you don't need a staff or an advocate. The PSC can handle them just as is, and they're perfectly well. But you periodically have a case that doesn't have particularly consumer implications, but has considerable implications for the industry as a whole. And under current circumstances, the testimony was the PSC creates a record with exhibits and things like that. But it's really not nearly as efficient a way to do it as if they had appointed one of their own staff members and said, you bring in a case and present a case to us so that we can have a record, so that we see both sides and can make a decision on this. And I don't think it would be used very often, but I think in some of the cases, and they cited a very specific one where they'd had a problem this way, where a consumer advocate had quite legitimately decided not to intervene. So this ability to go back and use basically a fragment of the old system in a particular kind of cases, Mr. Chairman, I think will be very useful.
Senator Case.
Thank you, and I appreciate the good comments from the Senator from Laramie County and the Senator from Natrona County. Testimony in the committee was that this would be a useful tool for the PSC because the consumer advocate does have priorities. I believe that, to be honest, I have never been quite a fan of the way this has been set up, but it is working. But the old way did work, too, and it really did work. And there was independence. What we did learn in committee is that there have been an inordinate number of cases settled without going to full-blown hearing. And to me, that is disturbing, especially in the case of major rate filings in the electric arena. I suspect that if consumer advocate, now if they don't enter into a case, there would be the possibility, and remember, we're only talking about two or three cases so far since the creation of the consumer advocate, but they were important cases to consumers, and they were not represented by the consumer advocate. This just fills in that gap. I think it's a good partnership system as we go forward, and it was supported by almost everyone that testified in front of the committee, I believe, including the chairman of the Public Service Commission.
Senator Rothman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I just have a question about this and a curiosity of how this would work in practice. If staff from the commission appears before the commission in a matter that's being decided by the commission, who are they advocating for? Are they allowed to advocate, or would they just be answering questions in a strictly informational fashion? If that's the case, which is what I suspect the intent would be, would we want to clarify that? Or would we want to leave that wide open?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, they would appear as a party, which would mean they would have to analyze the filings, look at things independently, maybe introduce exhibits that showed independent evidence, and they would adapt a point of view. So that the commission could have, they'd have a point of view of the whoever was filing the case, presumably a utility company or pipeline company or something like that, and then this staff point of view, and it would give the commission some balance that they could look at both sides of an issue, and have it organized and presented in an organized and public fashion, where the instead of the where the staff could then be rebutted by the company making the filing, and you would have a better decision made in consequence. But the staff member would essentially, after analyzing the facts, have to decide on a point of view to present.
Question having been called for, all those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 37, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 37 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 53.
Senate File 53, Petition Action Subject to Subdivision Law, sponsored by Senator Bebaum, an act relating to partitions of real property. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Christian, Kraft, and Driscoll. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 53, Partition Action Subject to Subdivision Laws. There are no standing committee amendments, and for further explanation of the bill, I would ask that you call on the sponsor.
Senator Bebaum.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate. The purpose of this bill, and it deals with partitions of real property, and it's an issue where you could have tenants in common on a piece of ground, you could have undivided interest, other types of combination of interest on that piece of ground, and the two parties, five parties, however many involved, cannot seem to get together on how to separate the property out. And so under our current law, there's what's called a right of petition, and there's a process set up for them to petition this property, and it goes through this process. A district judge is involved, and there's a committee set together, and they analyze, and they come back with a ruling on the petition on how they distribute the property. And, Mr. Chairman, what's happened under our current law, there's a big hole in that relative to subdivision laws in the state. And there's not been a lot of, I hate to use the word abuse, but there's not been a lot of instances where this has happened. But there was one particular one in Fremont County that I'll share with you, where there were 67 parcels that were divided under partition process. And of those 67 parcels, all of them were under 35 acres. There were 63 that were 10 acres or less, and it did not go through the subdivision process. So, Mr. Chairman, the purpose of this bill is to say that if, in fact, you go through a petition process because those parties that own the real property can't get along, that we have some law on the books that talks about how you deal with it relative to a subdivision. And, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the bill, it starts on page 1, line 10, under 132-103. This is the part of our law that deals with petitions, and the first part of it talks about the filing of that. And if you look at the language on bottom one and continuing over two, it says, if the petition seeks a division of property which result in a total of five or more units of land, and the division will otherwise be subject to the provision of titles, then they shall disclose the facts. So, Mr. Chairman, this is a filing and a disclosure part. The next part of that, Mr. Chairman, on page two is 132-104, which is findings of court. And it goes on to say that if the court finds its order dividing a property will result in a total of five or more units of land and division will otherwise be subject to the provisions of our subdivision laws, then the court shall order the petition only after compliance by the petitioner with those provisions. And Mr. Chairman, that takes care of the subdivision part of it. And you might ask why I came up with five or more units. And Mr. Chairman, the reason of that is if you understand and look at our subdivision laws as they now stand under 185306, there's a provision in there that if you have a piece of ground and you want to separate it under five parcels, that you are exempt from certain provisions of our subdivision law. It used to be called a simple subdivision, but we had some concerns about that. So we added a law, I think, in about 3 or 4 years ago that said that you can still have the simple subdivision, if you will, under 5 acres, under five units, but you have to provide with other provisions of the law. Then the last thing, Mr. Chairman, if you go to the bottom of page 2, it's 185303, and that's the exemptions from provision in the subdivision laws. Currently, a division of law or a division of land created by our partition is exempt totally. And what this does, Mr. Chairman, it puts in the provision that if you're going to do it for five or more parcels, then you have to go through the subdivision process like anyone else would have to. If it's five or less, then you're okay. And you might can say, well, why didn't we just eliminate it completely? And I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, that there was a little negotiating going on with me and numerous attorneys that represent people in partition processes, and we felt that this was sort of a fair in-between settlement. I'm not concerned so much about the five and under as I am about the large amounts that I talked about in Fremont County, so I'd be glad to answer any questions. I think it's a good bill. It doesn't make any sense at all that a lot of people have to comply with subdivision laws, but if you go through a partition process, you can go around them.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 53, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 53 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 58.
Senate File 58, Driver's License Suspension for Child Support Nonpayment, sponsored by Senator Johnson, and Act Relating to Child Support Enforcement. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Christensen, Kraft, and Driscoll. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 58, Driver's License Suspension for Child Support Nonpayment. There are no standing committee amendments, and for a further explanation of the bill, I'd ask that you call on the sponsor.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've always received calls through the years that I know many of you have, and it's from a single head of household mother with children, and her ex is playing games and she's not getting any child support at all, and the punishment for him is pretty light. There's a lot of this going on, and I got a phone call about 3 weeks before the session and told her I would find out if I could actually do something about it. She has two children, and her husband is gaming the system and getting away with it. So how does he game the system currently? Current law statute says if the obligor owes more than $5,000, has not made a payment for at least 90 days, DFS requests YDOT to suspend his license for 60 days. Every 90 days, the deadbeat dad goes in and pays $15, $15, $15, $5, pick a number, and the new 90 days starts all over again. Who's that hurting? It's hurting the children, and he has an obvious responsibility for those children, and the mothers struggle. They just don't make the money. So Senate File 58 is very clear and changes it. First of all, the obligor owes, has to owe more than $2,500 rather than $5,000. And instead of making a payment, he or she needs to make a full monthly support payment. And this has to be done every 60 days in case instead of every 90 days. What happens if they run out and the DFS computer grabs onto them a request to send over to YDOT about their license. YDOT investigates it and decides if it should be pulled or not, and they do all of the notifications. So it's really a simple bill, Mr. Chairman. It'll help the single head of household parent better support the children that both of them caused. And I stand.
Senator Anderson, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Indeed, a simple bill with for a very difficult problem, one which I think we can all sympathize with. Question that I would have in regard for a person's ability to pay and the importance of having a driver's license in many instances, and I guess I would just appreciate a little bit of thought that's been put into this if, in fact, this person had a CDL and how that might affect it. And I know that the CDL license, and I think perhaps that you have one, would have pretty good knowledge. You know, even a speeding ticket will jeopardize the keeping of a CDL. And then the other part is, we know, given distances and the type of work that we have in Wyoming, the importance of the having the ability to drive to work, whether it be on a rig or where it might be. I'd just like to have a little more explanation in regard to thought that's been given to that, what the consequences might be in regard to perhaps making the ability to pay even more difficult. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a quick question of how this reporting function might operate. You know, whether or not the Department of Family Services would contact the Highway Department, and then subsequent to that, whether or not the Highway Department is set up for this sort of thing. I just don't know.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, on and against this bill, the employees, we had experience with 800 or so employees in our employee, and they all had to drive to work. And some of them had to drive for work, which would mean that we're talking about cutting off the ability for that person to pay the child support at all if they lose their license. And the ones that can't drive to work, obviously, if they don't show up, they can't continue to make payment on anything. I have found that they guarantee the wages, and the court will do that, and the employer then pays that. The employee can continue to make money. I don't know why we would have to go to take his driver's license away when we can guarantee his wage. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll answer the last one first. The person can get what's called a hardship license going to and from work, period. And if they work driving, they can work driving, but period. They can't use it to go up to the lake on the weekend or to go skiing if it happens to be in the winter. Okay. Trying to remember the other ones. Oh, CDL is a driver's license. And if they have a CDL, and if it's an active CDL, they could try for a hardship permit on driving the CDL, or they could just simply pay their child support. I know what CDL drivers pretty well across the average make, and I know what the average child support in this state is. And if there's anybody that wouldn't have a problem keeping up, it would be a CDL driver. Now, remember, the parent who has to pay the child support can send it to DFS. They can take it into any of the county clerk of courts, and they can take it into any of the local DFS offices, and it's forwarded here to the enforcement office. What'd I forget?
Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, when we talked about this in committee, I was very impressed with the probation people, with their willingness to cooperate with the drivers. If a driver, if a a dad who's not paying his child support payments will come in and talk to these people. They're very reasonable and very willing and able to work out some kind of a deal with this person. And they have really great success with this. And so when I first saw this, I was determined I wasn't going to vote for this. But after listening to the lady from the child, from the department that does this, I was convinced that they go out of their way to try to make accommodations for these people before they lose their license. So it's not as bad as it looks.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given the lateness of the day and, kind of the issues that have been before us, I don't mean to sound argumentative or even contentious, but I have to say that I think the answer that I was given in regard to the CDL was certainly not one that satisfied my curiosity. It seems to me that it would be almost unbelievable that someone would receive a hardship license in order to perform the duties provided under CDL and expect that to be acceptable to the DOT. So I have to say that I would oppose the bill under that condition, or at least the condition as I understand it at this moment.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, either the sponsor or members of the committee can correct me on this, but the numbers quoted by the child support payment people at DFS was that we're only talking about 20 licenses throughout the entire state. So we're not talking about creating waves of unemployed driverless fathers all around the state. And as a matter of fact, I believe that with the previous imposition, with those gaming the system, once it came in, because we're just talking about closing a loophole. People are already losing their license over this. The number dropped significantly.
Question's been called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the committee whole rises to report, they do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 58, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The chair is not sure. All those in favor of Senate File 50, of Senator Burns' motion, will the committee the whole rise and report, please rise. Those opposed, please rise. Pursuant to Senate Rule 6.5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson District 2?
No.
Anderson District 28?
No.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
No.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstader?
No.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Emmerich?
No.
Escobel?
Aye.
Geis?
No.
Hastert?
Aye.
Hicks?
No.
Hines?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
No.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Rothfuss?
Aye.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott?
Aye.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Ross?
No.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 13 ayes, 17 noes.
Senate File 58, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 6-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 76.
Senate File 76, Bighorn Sheep Relocation, sponsored by Senator Hicks, and Act Relating to Game and Fish. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Burns, Christensen, Kraft, and Driscoll. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 76, Bighorn Sheep Relocation. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would ask that it be read in now. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, that's why I was late on getting up. I was waiting to hear that.
Senate File 76, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 2.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Standing Committee Amendment. And for a further explanation of both the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill, I ask that you call on the prime sponsor.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, everybody take a deep breath and hang on. This is a little bit of a complicated issue to get to it. I will tell you to date, this has been a well-traveled bill. It's been to the Joint Ag Committee, and it's been to the Appropriations Committee, and it's been to the Travel Recreation Committee. So half of you have already heard this bill in one form or fashion. But let me start out with giving you the impetus behind this bill, because without the background history, you'll be absolutely unable to make a decision on this bill. Back in 2000, this issue of bighorn sheep and domestic sheep has been a contentious issue for a long time. But in 2000, then-Governor Jim Geringer basically appointed a committee to start to evaluate how we can do business better in Wyoming and start to address this issue of disease transmission between domestics and wild sheep. That committee met for over 3 years. They come up with a statewide recommendations as a plan on how the state would operate. Under that plan, it was formally adopted in 2004. That committee that started in 2000 still meets every year, has met every year for the last 12 going on 13 years to continue to address this issue and how this issue of disease transmission between these species would operate within the state of Wyoming. The state of Wyoming's plan and the model that was developed at that time has now become a model that's spoken well of west-wide as an appropriate mechanism for separations, that the state should take the lead in developing these plans on how we keep these two species separate and viable within the state of Wyoming. Fast forward to 2003, the Medicine Bow National Forest wrote a recorded decision on how that forest would be managed, and that included managed for domestic livestock grazing and managed for wildlife. After that record of decision was signed into law, there was a couple of organizations, one in particular, that decided they didn't like the plan. They appealed the plan. The plan went all the way to the chief of the Forest Service. Subsequent to that, the state of Wyoming took a very strong position on that to defend Wyoming's plan. And at that time, the director of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department and the director of the Wyoming Department of Agriculture and our congressional delegation waded in and said, you know, Wyoming has the authority to manage our wildlife. We spent over 4 years on a collaborative process that invited all the participants in, including the land management agencies, on how we would develop this plan within the state of Wyoming. Well, we fast forward to last year, and a couple of organizations that have a long history of litigating any issue that they don't see fit is on how our federal land should be managed, pursued with the litigation in the federal court system on this issue
of bighorn sheep and domestic sheep on this particular forest in Wyoming, the Medicine Bow National Forest. I will give you a brief update, and then I'll go to the bill and the amendment, Mr. Chairman and members of this body. The state of Wyoming intervened in that lawsuit, and the intervention is to protect Wyoming's plan that served Wyoming very well for the last 12 to 13 years. In fact, underneath that plan, there's been three supplemental populations and reintroductions of bighorn sheep into the state of Wyoming. It served Wyoming well for wild sheep, and it served Wyoming well for domestic grazers on federal lands. This lawsuit has proceeded. One of the things that I want to bring your attention to is traditionally these groups have been at odds, but the wool growers in Wyoming and the sheep producers and the Wild Sheep Foundation that worked so diligently to put Wyoming's plan together said we have a lot of stake here. They intervened together along with one of the other sportsmen's groups and local governments into that lawsuit to basically defend Wyoming's plan. Not of the bill, but you've got a little bit of history. This bill is an insurance policy. That's all this is. This only goes into effect if the state and the interveners, which include the Wyoming Wild Sheep Foundation, Wyoming Wool Growers, local governments, and sportsmen organizations, lose in the federal court system. It's just an insurance policy. It's an insurance policy to say that the state of Wyoming owns the wildlife. The state of Wyoming has created a plan to manage the wildlife. That plan served the state well for over 13 years. And we are not going to allow these organizations to use the federal court systems to define how we're going to manage our wildlife and protect our industries within the state of Wyoming. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, if we'll go to the bill, if I can walk you through a couple of the amendments. The First Amendment on page 1, line 2, and line 3 are just to... Basically, it's a clerical definition. Bighorn is one word in reference to wild sheep. If you move down to line 1 and 14, or page 1, line 14 and 15, that's just clarifying language to make clear in this bill exactly where this bill pertains to. And the clarification there, because there was a little bit of confusion, this bill would not, and let me repeat, would not remove the Encampment River bighorn sheep herd. Now, I'll tell you, there's only about 25 to 35 sheep in that population. This bill, because the litigation is specific to the Medicine Bow National Forest, would only deal with those sheep that inhabit the Medicine Bow National Forest. Now, working with the Game and Fish Department and looking at their historical records and their recent census counts that indicated there's probably between 30 and 35 sheep total in this population, the vast majority of the time these sheep never go on the Medicine Bow National Forest. Based on all their census data and their observational data forms, there are very few sheep utilize the Medicine Bow National Forest. So again, it's not designed to remove that population, just those few number of sheep that may actually frequent the Medicine Bow National Forest. Effectively, what the bill does is it says, look, if you're going to use the federal court system to try to manage the wildlife, in this particular case, and I want to be very specific, only in this particular case would we have a situation where we would remove a few number of sheep. And that is consistent with Wyoming's plan. It's right on Wyoming Game and Fish Department's website. You can get on there and look that up. It's got all the meetings and the minutes that were collected. And in that plan, this is what we call a co-management area. And in that plan, it says domestic sheep will never be and won't be removed because of wild sheep, because this is the lowest priority herd within the state of Wyoming, given the size of this herd and the fact that there's no management plans in place to either improve the habitat or supplement the population. It's just a little relic population out there. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand to answer any questions this time.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. Do we have any statistics or reports on past attempts to relocate these bighorn sheep to other areas of the state? I know, Mr. Chairman, up in our area, those attempts have been made in the past, and it's been a miserable experience. It's I think it's been done two or three times and it's failed all three. You know, it's a part of wildlife. It's an animal that, well, I'll just put it this way, it's not like the wolves. The wolves, that project worked very well, but bighorn sheep is a little trickier. They don't like to be moved. And up in our area, I think the other wildlife in that area that feed on these bighorn sheep think it's a great program, but I'd just like to see that report and how successful this program is, if that's available.
Senator Landon, we are on the amendment.
Thank you.
Question on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion? Yeah. Excuse me. Senator Rothfuss.
Mr. Chairman, on the amendment, can we have an explanation of the amendment? Thank you.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, on the amendment, again, if you go to page 1, line 2, and page 1, line 3, that just is a grammatical correction that bighorn is one word. And if you go to page 1, line 14, page 1, line 15, the way that previously read, it was a little confusing talking about boundary lines. This just clarifies that this bill only deals with lands on the Medicine Bow National Forest. It has no implications to whatsoever to, on the other side of the boundary, which is BLM lands, for clarification. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for your favorable consideration of Standing Committee Amendment.
Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 76, please say aye. Those opposed, no. That amendment has passed. We are back on the bill. Yes, Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now that you got rid of that amendment, I appreciate that. And I just had a quick question to make sure I'm following. And given the hour of the day, that's probably why I'm not. But this insurance policy that you're advocating for, is that to assure that we're going to have the resources necessary if a federal court judgment comes down against us? Is that, am I reading correctly that would allow us then to go in and take care of that 35 head of sheep and get them somewhere else?
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I'll start with the first question dealing with the relocation issue. In the conversations, let me first back up. Yes and no is the correct answer. The simple fact is we haven't had great success in Wyoming with relocating Wyoming sheep, but we've had really good success in Wyoming over the last, I'll say, 10 years of bringing in sheep that are matched to their habitat. In fact, Wyoming brought into Bighorn County sheep out of Montana, and also Oregon that have done very well in that Devil's Canyon area of Bighorn County. We also, a couple of years after that, brought in additional sheep out of Montana that went into Platte County that have done very well over there in the Laramie Peak area. And most recently in Carbon County, they brought in supplemental sheep populations from Oregon, and then also move some of the Montana sheep out of Devil's Canyon to deal with this very issue of potential disease transmission into Carbon County, and those are doing very well. So the science has progressed to the point that we do have some real good success in the last 10 years. Again, those populations were brought in under Wyoming's plan. And without that plan, we probably would still be having a lot of arguments and litigation even within the state of today. The second question is the federal court order. The ways this would happen is if this came down and the federal courts ruled in favor of the litigants, what this does is provide an appropriation. Working with the Game and Fish Department, there's enough money in here. Average cost to net gun out of a helicopter, take to a trailer and move that sheep and relocate it is in the neighborhoods of about $800 to $1,000. So that appropriation there is if we had to move some of those sheep. I will tell you, in conversations with the department, if this bill had to kick in, they would probably move those sheep to Sebile Canyon and be involved in some level of disease research. I would just remind this body that 2 years ago you made an appropriation for $125,000 to address this issue. At that time, we talked about it at that time, and it was coming to Wyoming. The litigation was coming. That funding for that livestock wildlife disease partnership program, a good portion of that appropriation went to address this very issue, to conduct the research, to develop the vaccines. There's a good possibility, if these sheep had to be moved, that they would go to Sebile and be as part of that research project. With that, I'd ask for your favorable consideration on the bill.
Question been called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the committee of the whole rise to report, that are do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 76, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Senate File 76 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 75.
Senate File 75. Honor Farm Horse Program, sponsored by Senator Hicks, an act relating to state institutions. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agricultural State Public Lands and Water Resources, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Emmerich, Hicks, and Johnson. No, Senator Geis. Excuse, Senator Driscoll. Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the committee of the whole rise and report, I move that Senate File 76 do pass, and I'll yield the floor to Senator Hicks to explain the bill.
Senator Geis, that was Senate File 75.
75.
Mr. Chairman, Senator there Hicks. Is a committee of the whole amendment. Could I have that read in at this time?
Senate File 75, Committee of the Amendment, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Senator Von Flater.
Thank you, sir. I just want to make sure we move the bill, because I think I just went right into the amendment there and nobody had moved the bill yet, unless I missed that.
Senator Geis did move the bill.
My mistake.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is a very simple bill. It does one thing. I'm just going to walk you through a real little close piece of history on here so you know how this bill works in context. In 2002, the state of Wyoming proceeded with a legal action against the Bureau of Land Management for mismanagement of wild horses. In 2003, the state of Wyoming entered into a federal consent decree with the Bureau of Land Management that the Bureau conceded that they would manage the wild horse herds in Wyoming at the appropriate management level. Prior to that, they were running in some herds 3 to 4 times number of horses what they said that they had the carrying capacity of the range. In several circumstances, livestock producers had to take were denied turnout because of the large number of wild horses, and there was substantial damage to some of the wildlife habitat associated with these overpopulations. That consent decree was signed for a period of 10 years. It expires in 2013. The Bureau of Land Management has indicated that they have absolutely no interest whatsoever of renewing that consent decree with the state of Wyoming to continue to manage horses at the appropriate management level. So you can figure out where this is going. We're probably going to go back to the previous years of overpopulations of Wyoming horses on the public domain. One of the things that's exacerbating this issue is none of the other states had a consent decree. For the last 10 years, while the BLM wasn't fully compliant with that decree, they lived up to the spirit and have actually done probably a better job of keeping the numbers at appropriate management level in the last 10 years than any time in previous history. But once this consent decree goes away, we're likely to see a substantial amount of money being shifted from Wyoming to other states to gather these wild horses. Wyoming, through our Department of Corrections, runs an ARNA farm program where we bring a lot of horses off the BLM, could be the Park Service in the case of the herd up there in Bighorn County, and bring those into that program. We feed them, train them, work with them, and then they go out for sales. What this bill basically does is just say, now, once the floodgates open from other states, that we're going to reserve those facilities in Wyoming for Wyoming horses. What we probably are going to anticipate to see, and we did a tour of that facility up there last year, and currently Corrections is taking in about 6 to 8% of their total population of horses is coming out of other states. But that could be a substantial number when you put that in context of what the Wild Horse and Burro program does. That could be because it's not unusual for them to have over 200 horses in that facility. So you're saying, well, if it's 6%, that's, you know, 12 or 14 horses. But what that effectively does is leave those 12 or 14 horses out on the public domain in Wyoming for 3 years. They reproduce. It could be a substantial number of AUMs that are being removed. So the only thing this bill does is saying, look, if you're going to bring horses into our program where the state's going to subsidize the training, gentling, and sales of these horses, we're only going to take Wyoming horses. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to speak to the amendment. The amendment just brings in another provision.
Senator Hicks.
During testimony.
Senator Hicks, could you move that amendment?
Could I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 75? Speak to that amendment. During testimony, speed reader, we read it in? Okay. Only thing the amendment does is during testimony, what we found out is periodically the Department of Corrections in Wyoming, through their horse program, will have a special request to bring in a certain type of horse or a different type of horse that once in a great while isn't available in Wyoming. And I'm going to give you the example. When we were up there on our Judiciary Committee, they actually had brought one horse out of California. Was a specific color of horse. They needed a Palomino because the United States Marine Corps wanted a horse for their program to be able to use in their proceedings and their displays. Periodically, they've had requests from Border Patrol for certain color of horse. So what this amendment does is just say under those special situations, the Department of Corrections, very small, limited number of animals, that they could go out and bring in from other states for those type of specific purposes. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for your favorable consideration on the Committee of the Whole Number 1.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm the freshman here, and there's a lot of words I don't know, and I don't know what they mean. But I got a question on line, I think it's line 14 of the amendment. There's a, it must be some kind of horse word. It's purse post of the correctional facility. I don't know what that one means. It must be some horsey thing Hicks came up with, or Senator from up there came up.
And I don't think that's a horse word. I think that has to do with some specific program that the Department of Corrections runs, and maybe the attorneys in the audience are more familiar with that legal jargon than I am.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, my question is, up in the northern part of the state, there's a herd of wild horses that moves back and forth across the Wyoming-Montana line. Does this take care of which side of the line they're on? They do manage that herd. Can we still take horses from that herd in the northern part of the state? And will we have to verify that they were captured in Wyoming, even though they go back and forth across the line?
Is this pertinent to the amendment? Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it is pertinent. There's 8 horses allowed under this. theoretically, if one of those horses was captured across the line in Montana, they'd do something else with them. In fact, I think when they go to cull that herd, they do all the things they do. And sometimes horses that are actually native to Montana can be on the Wyoming side and vice versa. And we're going to get into a big, you know, where was this horse found or captured or however we fold or whatever it is. In other words, would they be eligible under this eight-horse rule?
To answer the good senator's from Casey's question, the way I would interpret it would be absolutely. They have a quota. How they choose to use that quota is strictly up to the Department of Corrections. Mr. Chairman, I would also like to make sure that we read into the record that on that standing committee or committee of the whole number one on line 14, that word does need to be corrected. So with that, Chairman, I would ask for your favorable consideration on the bill. Call.
Question's been called for. All those in favor of Senator Hicks' motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 75, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Question on the bill. Are you ready? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 75, I'll say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 75 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority, floor leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Mr. President.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 6, do pass. Senate File 28, do pass. Senate File 105, do pass, amended. Senate File 83, do pass, amended. Senate File 87, do pass, amended. Senate File 39, do pass, amended. Senate File 19, do pass, amended. Senate File 37, do pass, amended. Senate File 53, do pass. Senate File 58, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senate File 76, do pass, amended. And Senate File 75, do pass, amended. Senator Emmerich, Chairman.
Senator Emmerich.
Mr. President.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's been carried and the report has been adopted. Messages from the House.
January the 21st, 2013. From the House of Representatives, message number 153, Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the Committee of the Whole report, failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill number 22, Serious Bodily Injury, ayes 22, noes 37, excused 1. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
January the 21st, 2013. Mr. President, your committee number two, Appropriations. to whom was referred Senate File 90, Administrative Control of Acquired Institutional Lands. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Dockstader, Hastert, Meyer, and Perkins, Senator Bebout, Chairman. January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 16, Aeronautics Programs, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Dockstader, Hastert, Meyer, and Perkins, Senator Bebout, Chairman. January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 72, Medicaid Benefit Recovery, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Dockstader, Hastert, Meyer, and Perkins, Senator Bebout, Chairman. January the 21st, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 125, Public Employees Requirements Upon Rehiring 2. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Dockstader, Meyer, and Perkins. No, Senator Hastert. Senator Bebout, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I'd like to move that we stand, or I do move that we stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Tuesday, January 22nd.
Announcement, Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources, will meet tomorrow night upon adjournment, and we'll take up Senate File 112, Raw Milk, Senate File 137, Protection of Animals.
Senator Ron Flater.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee Number 8, Transportation and Highways and Military Affairs, will meet in approximately 10 minutes, 5 minutes to the hour, room S14, to consider bills Senate File 29, Hitchhiking, Senate File 93, Use of Cell Phones While Driving, Senate File 116, School Bus Driver Cell Phone Use, Senate File 126, Overweight and Oversized Vehicles.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, I'd like to amend the announcement for our committee meeting tomorrow morning, 8 a.m., for Committee Number 6, Tribal Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, in room S14. Anybody who's seen the announcement, it says room S1, and that's not correct. It'll be S14. And we will be... I take that back. Yeah. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Here we go. I'm sorry. It'll be S14, and we will be studying committee Senate File 114, Assault of Health Care Providers, Senate File 115, Protective Services Investigation Amendments, and Senate File 132, Silencers, Suppressors, and Automatic Weapons.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I've been asked to remind the Senate of the shrimp bash that the insurance agents are putting on for us the holiday and this evening.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee Number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow, 30 minutes after noon recess, to pick or take up Senate File 100, Sales Tax Overpayments Refund Period, up in room S16.
Further announcements? Senator, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. This is a reminder to the Rules Committee meeting tomorrow morning at 9:15 to consider the Revisor's Bill, Senate File 61.
Any further announcements? You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. Senate will stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 22nd.